Military veterans in Ukraine have gotten used to fighting Russia, and they're gearing up again. Whatever support they get from the outside, they appreciate.
I want to say thank you. Your country is helping us, and all this going from your taxes.
Also today, army officers in Myanmar order troops to shoot peaceful protesters. For this soldier, though, he says that's something he just can't do. I'm Marco Werman, and one way to hurt Russia? Remove the country from the modern banking system. Some say, though, the dollar will find a way.
You know, if you've got to send it by horseback across the Urals, you're going to do it.
Plus, volcano-stricken Tonga opens up to aid workers. Was that the link to a massive jump there in COVID cases? We'll find out. All of that today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us. President Biden is sending American troops to Europe. 2,000 additional U.S. troops will be deployed to Germany, Poland, and Romania. The announcement came today from Pentagon spokesman John Kirby.
The United States stands shoulder to shoulder with our NATO allies. The current situation demands that we reinforce the deterrent and defensive posture on NATO's eastern flank.
Kirby said this is a response to the buildup of Russian troops along its border with Ukraine.
I want to be very clear about something. These are not permanent moves. They are moves designed to respond to the current security environment. Moreover, these forces are not going to fight in Ukraine. They are going to ensure the robust defense of our NATO allies.
Kirby said the moves will send a strong signal to Russian President Vladimir Putin and to the world. The Pentagon has already put 8,500 American troops on higher alert for possible deployment to Europe. On Tuesday, Putin spoke publicly about the Ukraine crisis and accused the West of trying to provoke Russia into war. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, authorities are saying there's no need to panic. Still, many remain prepared for whatever comes next. The World's Daniel Hoffman is in the capital, Kyiv, where he's been speaking with veterans of Ukraine's military.
Ekaterina Primak was in grade school in the mid-1990s, and she remembers learning about how her country decided to give up its nuclear weapons. She says she was proud to be a Ukrainian.
Knowing that we are a peaceful country, it inspired me.
Primak is referring to the Budapest Memorandum. President Bill Clinton hailed the agreement when he visited here in 1995.
Ukraine chose to give up nuclear weapons when the former Soviet Union dissolved. Your decision has made the Ukrainian people, the American people, and the entire world much safer and more secure.
Ukraine gave up its nukes. The U.S. and Britain gave security assurances of territorial integrity, sovereignty, and independence. The former Soviet state was on a new path. But the agreement did not prevent Russia from illegally annexing the Crimean Peninsula and attacking eastern Ukraine back in 2014. Ekaterina Primak was 21 years old at the time, and she decided to join the military.
I said, enough watching the news. Let's see what's actually going on there.
Primak served on the front lines as a medic, and it wasn't easy, especially for a woman in uniform.
The army is a patriarchal structure where they're used to only men being around. Therefore, women have to always prove that they're better than them.
Today, Primak advocates for the rights of female service members and veterans. She says in recent years, Ukraine's military has become more inclusive.
There are way more women in the army right now. If we include women who work in the Ministry of Defense, women make up 25% of the military.
Primak says that's crucial because Ukraine needs every person they could get. When I ask her about Ukraine's security situation right now, with Russian troops gathering at the border, here's what she says.
They've already been our enemy for 8 years. They've waged a hybrid war against us for 8 years. And all those troops at the border, that doesn't bring up the threat level. It's just another tool they're using in an ongoing war against us.
Russia wants to create panic in Ukraine, Primak says, and that's not happening. But she says her family is planning for the worst-case scenario of a full-blown Russian invasion.
I have a plan for my grandmother. I will evacuate her. I want my close family to be safe. We can't live in fear, but we must have a plan.
Other vets I meet here say they're making similar plans. Viktor Pilipenka is advising his extended family to prepare to get out of the capital.
I have one nephew and two nieces, and I am advising my sister, if the war will happen, I am advising her to leave to the West. She's the mother of three children, and she cannot risk their lives, and she cannot risk her own life.
Pilipenka says he gave his parents the same advice.
Because from there, they will be able to help me fighting here. That's simple. Because there won't be any use of them staying here under shellings.
Viktor Pilipenko, though, is not going anywhere. He's in the Army Reserve, so in the event of a larger conflict, he knows that he'll probably go to the front lines.
I know that war is destruction and evil, but still, I'm ready. I'm ready to fight because I have an experience. I'm ready to help and assist other guys and ladies. No problem with that.
Pilipenka has combat experience. He served in eastern Ukraine from 2014 to 2016. Those were tough times to be in the army because the force simply was not prepared. Another veteran, Leonid Astaltsev, tells me the Ukrainian military simply didn't have the gear they needed.
It was bad because our army was looks like a homeless, you know, in the United States. And when the war starts, we have the army, but we don't have the army.
Astaltsev says that on one occasion he had to do a Google search about how to set up a military checkpoint because he and his fellow service members had no military experience.
We didn't know anything. I was a pizzaiola. The friends of mine was different workers of factory. We weren't military. We don't know anything about this.
Astaltsev remembers getting some much-needed aid from the U.S. back then. It came in the form of military food rations called MREs, or meals ready to eat.
We had one MRE for three guys for 2 days. And it was like, it's very good. They had Skittles in it. Yeah, it's very good.
Veterans tell me that the Ukrainian military has come a long way. It's a more formidable force in 2022. And Astaltsev says that's thanks in part to support from America and its Western partners.
I want to say thank you. Your country is helping us. And all this going from your taxes. So thank you, Americans, for buying for us something useful and that good and pleasure that the most powerful country in the world are helping us.
I asked Leonid Astaltsev about what's going to happen next. He says he has no idea what Russian President Vladimir Putin is planning. People keep asking him this question, he says, and he just doesn't know. But he will be ready to join the fight if he needs to.
We'll have a phone call and we will have instructions what we need to do and in what time. I think in 1 day we will be there, even less than 1 day. Yeah.
And have there already been like warning messages or information that's come out recently?
No, and it will not be the warning messages. It will be one message. Go. And okay, we will go.
Ekaterina Primak, the former medic, tells me she appreciates the support Ukraine is getting from its partners at this critical time, but she also says she wishes that the country didn't need outside assistance.
Freedom is in our DNA. You can't find a people who value liberty and freedom as much as we do.
Primak says she's hoping for a brighter future, a future where Ukrainians won't have to worry about a threat of conflict with their Russian neighbors. Reporting from Kyiv, for the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
The U.S. is threatening severe economic consequences against Russia as a standoff with Ukraine continues. One sanction many experts see as an option is blocking the country from using the SWIFT bank messaging system. If you have ever wired money overseas, you know about this. SWIFT is an acronym for the old-school sounding Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications. People around the world depend on SWIFT numbers to enable secure money transfers between banks. And the Russian prime minister has said blocking the country from using SWIFT would be a declaration of war. Brian O'Toole is a former U.S. Treasury Department official and an expert on sanctions. Brian, let's start with what SWIFT is. What does it do exactly in the most practical sense?
It provides a secure messaging service. That's really it. It's an oversimplification to say it, but it's basically Microsoft Outlook. You're a big bank and you're processing millions of payments a day. Making sure things are where you expect them to be in different fields and things like that, it turns out to be really important from a technology perspective.
Now, this has been tried before. In 2018, the U.S. used SWIFT sanctions against 30 Iranian financial institutions. How did the U.S. pull that off, and did it actually end up hurting Iran economically?
Congress in the United States got involved with trying to shut down these financial messaging services to Iran as a way to kind of amplify the financial embargo that was already in place. But that's the key point here. The financial embargo on Iran was already in place. And then SWIFT becomes cleanup, right? If they're cut off from the U.S., you then turn to something like SWIFT messaging. So it makes it harder for Russian banks to transact with China and other places. Russia's nowhere close to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. Former special envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, called SWIFT sanctions against Russia a nuclear option. It sounds like you don't agree with that.
If you want to cut banks off from transacting with Russian banks, you don't remove, you know, Microsoft Outlook, they can just go get a Gmail account, or in this case, Telex.
Telex. Haven't heard that word for a while.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the other like major international system for these messages. There would be payment disruption. So you'd have late payments. You'd have some payments that might not get through. But fundamentally, right, if you are a European company and you're paying for energy to Russia, you're going to find another way to do it. You're contractually obliged to make that payment. And, you know, if you've got to send it by horseback across the Urals, you're going to do it. And that's why, in my view, SWIFT is a silly discussion point now until there is a financial embargo in place.
So if it's not SWIFT, Brian, in your mind, what would be the most powerful single sanction when it comes to Russia?
I mean, look, setting aside blocking Rosneft, one of the largest oil companies on the planet, a huge portion of Russia's budget, which probably not in the cards.
Why wouldn't going after the Russian energy giant Rosneft work? Why do you think that's a non-starter?
Well, the whole point of sanctions is to hurt the other guy more than yourself. And so you want to minimize collateral. Rosneft is, by most accounts, one of the largest energy producers on the planet for oil. If you game it out and the Russians try to invade the Baltics, you know, then maybe we're talking about something different here. The biggest set of sanctions that can be imposed are kind of your traditional financial asset freeze sanctions, blocking sanctions against major Russian banks.
And how likely would sanctions like those be? Can you imagine them happening?
Absolutely. This is, I think, what the administration is telegraphing to the Russians is coming, is these state-owned banks are the targets.
Just mechanically, how do you block a major Russian bank?
There's plenty of authority already on the books for the United States. All they have to do is name the banks, essentially. And by naming those banks as specially designated nationals, the assets in the U.S. are required to be frozen, and no U.S. bank can transact or otherwise deal with those banks. And that includes clearing transactions directly or indirectly. And the indirectly part is really important, because if you're transacting between currencies, it's very, very difficult to do that in any sort of volume without having to go through a dollar step.
Business has to, at some point, have money that must be changed into dollars. Is the dollar's power why sanctions ultimately work?
Financial sanctions especially, yeah. It absolutely. U.S. sanctions are disproportionately powerful because of the dollar's role in global financial flows.
Brian O'Toole is a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council, breaking down for us the SWIFT banking system and other possible economic sanctions that might be used on Russia. Brian, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a deadly attack by militants in West Africa has the entire nation of Ghana on high alert. You're with the world.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. The island nation of Tonga has gone into lockdown after reporting several cases of COVID. This is happening, of course, just as Tonga is trying to recover from wide-scale damage caused by the eruption of a massive underwater volcano last month. The violent eruption killed three people, knocked out most of the internet and phone service, and covered entire landscapes in volcanic ash. Reporter Ashley Westerman in Manila joins me with the latest. What is known about these newly recorded COVID-19 cases, Ashley?
Yeah, so the first cases were announced on Tuesday. The Tongan prime minister said the two individuals who tested positive were working at a wharf in Nuku'alofa, the capital, handling aid coming in from abroad to help with the recovery after the volcanic eruption.
So is the thinking then that the two Tongan citizens may have gotten infected through contact with the people delivering aid?
You know, officials are not entirely sure because you have to remember the Tongan government said all aid would be delivered without contact. So it's just not certain at this point.
What else do we know at this point about the people who've been infected?
Well, the prime minister did not reveal their names or what ships they worked with, but they did say that the two individuals did not show any symptoms and have been placed in isolation. But still, these cases prompted a call for a countrywide lockdown because there's fear that close contacts of these two people are believed to have traveled to other islands in Tonga. That was yesterday. Now, today, the prime minister announced three more cases have been confirmed, a woman and her two children. And we have to remember, Mark, so until these five most recent cases, Tonga only had one recorded COVID-19 case since the start of the pandemic. And that person was being repatriated last October and tested positive while in quarantine and was no longer infectious.
Yeah, that's kind of extraordinary. So now Tonga is going into lockdown. For how long?
So Tonga went into lockdown today, starting at 6 p.m. their time. I was able to get a hold of Tonga's High Commissioner's office in London. They confirmed the COVID cases as well as the lockdown. And in the email, the commissioner's office said the lockdown will remain in place for 48 hours. And then the government will reassess to decide if they need to continue it. However, essential workers and people helping distribute aid are exempt from the lockdown.
So how are people in Tonga reacting?
You know, what little news is getting out of Tonga right now is reporting long lines outside of stores in the capital. People are panic buying, and there's a lot of uncertainty on the ground there. You know, experts say an outbreak could overwhelm Tonga's healthcare system. So officials are obviously being very careful in handling this. Though I do think it's worth mentioning, though, Marco, that according to their Ministry of Health, more than 83% of Tonga's population of just over 101,000 people are fully vaccinated.
Ashley, there's still the cleanup underway after the volcano eruption last month. How will the lockdown affect that recovery?
That's not entirely certain yet. Again, the government asked for contactless aid delivery, and that appears to potentially not have worked. But until now, aid has been flowing in from lots of places, groups like UNICEF to Chef Jose Andreas's World Central Kitchen. I spoke with Carla Taylor. She's the Disaster Risk Management Coordinator for the Pacific for International Federation for Red Cross Red Crescent. She's in Fiji and says her group has been sending things like tents, hygiene kits, and tarps over the last couple weeks. She also said that they've been working to get people in touch with their loved ones inside Tonga. That's still really difficult to get in touch with people there because of that damaged underwater fiber optic cable. Here's Carla Taylor with Red Cross Red Crescent.
So if family in the Philippines that are still looking to speak to their loved ones, to contact the Philippine Red Cross, and that could get organized through our international system to connect with anyone if that's still a need.
She also says they're looking at long-term housing solutions for those who lost their homes following the eruption.
Reporter Ashley Westerman in Manila, updating us on the situation in Tonga. Ashley, thank you very much for the update.
Thanks for having me.
A five-hour gun battle broke out at the presidential palace in Guinea-Bissau yesterday. Security forces thwarted what may have been an attempted coup. Successful coups d'etat have become relatively common in West Africa lately, one in Mali last year, another in Burkina Faso last month. The coups have largely been driven by the government's inability to protect their citizens. Concerns have also now spilled into Ghana. On Sunday, there was a deadly attack by militants in Burkina Faso along its border with Ghana. Authorities in Ghana have now put their entire country on high alert. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman is in Ghana's capital, Accra. What happened on Sunday in Burkina Faso, Ridwan, along the border with Ghana?
Marco, so over the weekend, there was an attack at a town in Burkina Faso, which shares a border with a town in Ghana called Kulungungu. 12 people were killed and a few more have been abducted during that attack. Now, preliminary investigations by the Ghanaian security authorities point to the fact that this attack was launched by a jihadist group in Burkina Faso. And so at the moment, Ghana is on high security alert. We also understand that some 1,235 Burkinabes are seeking shelter and safety in the northern part of Ghana. I spoke with the coordinator for the Ghana Refugees Board, Tete Paddy, who confirmed this.
We are about to go to the field and check whether these people are actually genuine asylum seekers.
So he is saying that some sort of profiling will be done on these Burkinabe migrants to establish whether they are genuine asylum seekers and not members of these jihadist groups.
We've been watching slowly as these jihadist groups move from the Sahel in the north, near Burkina Faso in Mali, further south. What exactly are the Ghanaian authorities doing about the security situation?
Well, the news about the jihadists has unsettled the entire nation. Many people have been gripped by fear. Security reinforcement has been activated at various entry points of the country. Military helicopters have been around border towns, while military and police officials in armored vehicles are on patrol at vantage points.
So as I said, this is now a regional conflict, not isolated just to Mali, spreading south from Mali through Burkina Faso and now on Ghana's border. This must be on everyone's minds.
Absolutely, Marco. I spoke with a security analyst here in Accra, Adib Sani, who says there are concerns of conflict spilling over into other countries.
The possibility of militants going beyond their base in Burkina Faso and Mali into other countries is very high, particularly Ghana, which I must say has largely remained untouched so far as the terrorism scourge is concerned in West Africa.
So, Ridwan, you're in Accra, the capital and the city furthest away from the violence in the north. What is the mood in Accra?
People are really worried, but the truth is that so many times the country has been put on high alert. But the consolation for many ordinary people has been that Ghana has always had a low-risk status, largely because the country's military has a wealth of experience in peacekeeping. This notwithstanding, the Ghanaian president is a worried man. Nana Akufo-Addo wants the urgency of the problem tackled as soon as possible.
The happenings in the region tell us that not everybody has accepted democracy as the preferred mode of governance. We still have some work to do to convince such people that we are all safer under democracy.
And just to mention that there is an emergency meeting that will be taking place tomorrow by ECOWAS. And on top of the agenda is Burkina Faso. West African nationals will be monitoring keenly, hoping that their leaders can bring closure to these security challenges.
Journalist Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, updating us on security concerns now in Ghana. Ridwan, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Marco.
You're listening to The World. Marco here. We were blown away by the support we received during our 2021 fundraiser. Over 775 listeners made donations to support The World. Here are just a few of those supporters. Susan Murray, William Pace, Daniel Walker, Matsuko Wennerston, Marjorie Grayville, Susan Fuller, Diana Luo, Kamradeen Mithani, Eric Young, Rachel Ratner. While I'm not able to individually thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single person who listens to the show. Throughout the pandemic, huge weddings in India have been taboo, a business nightmare for caterers and wedding planners. Now, they're ready to ramp up again.
People are looking forward to, are waiting to just find a reason to celebrate. And that's what our country is all about. Isn't it beautiful that they just look forward to celebrate?
All set to party in India. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Myanmar and Southeast Asia, things are falling apart. 1 year ago this week, the military seized power in a coup. The army imprisoned elected leaders and thousands of civilians. The military also killed some 1,500 people. The country and its economy are both in chaos. Today, the second in a two-part series about what's basically turned into a civil war in Myanmar. This is the story of a young army soldier told by The World's Patrick Nguyen and co-reporter Mong Mo. Mong Mo works under a professional name because reporting on the military in Myanmar puts you at great risk. And a quick word of warning, there are descriptions of violence. Please take care while listening.
On the morning of the coup last year, when tanks rolled in and troops raided government buildings, most people in Myanmar felt fear or rage. Sergeant Pyo Wai-U was shocked. No one told him this was brewing. But when he looked around his military camp, his fellow soldiers seemed amused. Everyone was like, great, the army's in control, we'll probably get a raise. At the time, Sergeant Pyo served in a light infantry battalion. These troops have a reputation for brutalizing ethnic minorities in the borderlands. Ethnic cleansing against Rohingya Muslims, that was them. Now, Sergeant Pyo had never shot anyone, but that's what he was trained to do. And when young protesters took to the streets, chanting for the army to stand down, the sergeant wondered, will they send us out to deal with them? He says, I tried to tell my peers, look, they're just protesting. They're being peaceful about it. The other soldiers, who only watched army propaganda channels on TV, they thought the protesters were losers. Their commanders, however, told them, no, these people are a threat. Sergeant Pyo says, our commanders told us, don't travel outside the base alone. Those crazy protesters will beat you to death. Soon afterwards, when some protesters did start fighting back, the army started calling them terrorists. And at that point, the sergeant knew. Any sympathy with the resistance would be dangerous. The army became super controlling, always checking soldiers' phones. If you looked at the wrong social media post, Pyo says, you'd be thrown into a cell, or worse. Sergeant Pyo wondered, what is it they don't want me to see? So he looked online, in secret, and what he saw, it blew his mind. Since the coup in Myanmar, social media has been the antidote to military propaganda. The army will say regular folks hate this uprising. But go online and you'll see videos like this. Whole towns are cheering on the resistance, chanting, our cause, our struggle. The army also says lots of protesters are jobless drug addicts. But go online and you'll see creative revolutionaries building DIY rockets or even holding 3D printed guns. That is a store-bought drone rigged to drop a bomb on military forces. Social media also connects people who've been taught to distrust each other. In Myanmar, the majority ethnic group is Burmese. Like most soldiers, Sergeant Pyo is Burmese. The generals are all Burmese. Starting in grade school, the military government teaches kids that Burmese army rulers have to be harsh with unruly folks in the mountains. Ethnic minority rebels and terrorists who won't accept the occupation of their native lands. But Gen Z and millennials in Myanmar today, the online generations, they're just not buying it. Here's my co-reporter, Mong Mo.
Many people are getting rid of their old-fashioned ideologies. You know, all these messages were wiped off from their brains.
Many young Burmese in the cities, taught to look down on minorities, realized, wait, they've been fighting the military for decades. We're not better than them. We need their help.
And then they realized that they should receive resistance training from their ethnic brothers.
Tens of thousands of young men and women have poured into the jungle. And now anyone on Twitter can watch clips of guerrilla fighters from minority groups such as the Kachin or the Karen battling the central military, fighting alongside Burmese from the cities. People who, before the coup, were garment stitchers or soup vendors or white-collar cubicle types. This is the army's worst nightmare. No wonder they don't want a young soldier, like Sergeant Pyo Wai-U, to see this stuff. Back on his military base, the orders started coming in. Yes, infantry would go into neighborhoods to crush protest by force. Sergeant Pyo says he felt sick. He asked infantrymen coming back from the protest, did you kill people? Some said, we tried to shoot over their heads. But clearly not all of them did that. In the capital, Naypyidaw, not long after the coup, there was this 20-year-old woman, Mya Twe Twe Kine, a grocery store clerk, who went to a protest. She was standing in a crowd when she got shot in the head, randomly picked off. Clearly, this was meant to terrify the others. Video of her murder went viral online, and it got stuck in Sergeant Pyo's mind. Sergeant Pyo realized, I can't do that. Even if they give the orders, I'm not going to shoot people. So one day, he snuck out of the army camp, got on a bus, and headed east toward the mountains, into the territory of the Karen, an indigenous people with their own guerrilla forces. And that's where he is now. He's hoping to fight with them, waiting for them to trust that some guy from a notorious infantry division is sincere, that he's not a spy. He's still waiting. He says, even though Myanmar's military has better weapons, how can they win with everyone against them? Pyo Wai U is no longer a sergeant, of course, but he still checks army propaganda once in a while just because he's curious. At least now, he says, he doesn't have to pretend to believe those lies. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen, co-reporting with Mong Mo.
Israel is punishing three soldiers involved in the death of an elderly Palestinian-American man. Two officers were dismissed and one was reprimanded following the death of Omar Assad. Assad died in January after he was arrested and assaulted in the West Bank. The U.S. State Department and American lawmakers had been calling for an investigation into the matter. Human rights groups want things to go further. They say this case simply highlights the fears Palestinians face in the West Bank under Israel's occupation since 1967. For more on this, we're joined by Avner Gvariahu. He's a former Israeli soldier and the co-director of the Israeli human rights group, Breaking the Silence. What is your reaction, Avner, to the news around the dismissal and reprimand of the Israeli soldiers in this case? You see this as Israel taking seriously what happened?
We are still pretty extremely surprised with the amount of reactions. The operation in which the 80-year-old Palestinian was handcuffed and blindfolded and thrown in the middle of a freezing night in an area north of Ramallah is probably one of the most mundane day-to-day operations that soldiers carry out. They don't always end with an 8-year-old dying.
So how do you see Israel's new government handling this case? And do you think there's a chance this might work to reform how the military actually interacts with Palestinians on a daily basis?
Sadly, the answer is no. We have a unique coalition government, but still we're talking about a right-wing-led government where the Minister of Defense, who a former chief of staff, first response to the death of Assad was basically automatically just dismissing it.
I suppose we should not be surprised that this would lead to the death of a 78-year-old man gagged and bound in the cold, resulting in a fatal heart attack. But if this happens to a 78-year-old man, is it happening a lot in cases where the person detained is a lot younger and not dying and not making headlines?
Exactly. As a soldier, I served as a paratrooper, special ops. You know, I would walk around our base and see Palestinians who were handcuffed and blindfolded. It's a very common thing to see as a soldier. In many cases, Palestinians will be arrested or detained just for being in the wrong place in the wrong time or for not answering quickly enough. Or in the case of this 80-year-old Palestinian who apparently didn't have his ID or answered back, that's really the nature of occupation.
Yeah, to that point, Amnesty International yesterday joined a chorus of various organizations and people calling Israel an apartheid state in a new report. Do you agree with that labeling?
You know, I think the first and most important thing to say about the report is that this is one out of many reports, right? There's sort of a growing consensus around human rights communities, organizations, including Israeli organizations, related to the crime of apartheid. And I think that the question is no longer if, but where. We're a group of former Israeli soldiers who bring forward our experience about what's happening in the occupied territories. So in that sense, our mandate is limited to the occupied territories. And as an organization, we haven't explored the question of beyond that. I think that when we're talking about the reality in the occupied territories, you know, we're definitely talking about a discriminatory system that amounts to apartheid. In my view, personally, I mean, I think this reality of dominance over the Palestinian population is not only clear and systematic in the occupied territories, but has been normalized and is being entrenched.
Avner Gvariahu is a former Israeli soldier and the co-director of the Israeli human rights group, Breaking the Silence. He joined us from Tel Aviv. Avner, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
No matter where you go in the world, weddings are a big deal. But in India, they're at a whole nother level. Indians can spend up to a fifth of their lifetime earnings on a wedding. Let that sink in. One out of every $5 you will ever earn gets tied up in a wedding party. The splashiest weddings have reportedly cost more than $100 million to stage. Yesterday on the show, we heard from two brides who had their wedding dreams nearly dashed by the pandemic. On the other side of the equation, 10 million people. That's how many are employed by the Indian wedding industry. And as the world's Chavi Sachdev reports from Mumbai, with COVID restrictions and lockdowns, the industry has had to adapt.
I love attending weddings. I love the food, the dressing up, the dancing. The longest one I attended was 4 days and involved 10 outfit changes. And that wasn't even a destination wedding, where the entire hotel turns into a 24/7 wedding party with new friends.
I've done wedding as intimate as 100 people and as large as 14, 15,000 people.
That's Birju Gariba, who runs Iskra Events and Celebrations, a wedding planning company in Mumbai. He says the sweet spot for a wedding is 350 guests, or used to be. With the pandemic, restrictions on social gatherings have brought the industry to an abrupt halt. Gariba says 2020 was a wipeout. And then in 2021, every time things looked up, they would crash.
I remember in April, May, June, July, when the second wave, which was quite a nasty one, came in, we had in excess of 8 to 10 weddings and all of them had to be either pushed or cancelled.
In Delhi, Amitabh Singh concurs. Over a dodgy line, he told me that pre-pandemic, his company, Safari Grills, used to do about 40 weddings a year, where they took care of everything except the band. And the number of people behind the scenes?
Easily in a wedding for 500 plus people, some on an average, if you were to take service personnel and everybody else, would be close to 170 to 200 people.
That's almost a third the number of guests. And what do they do? The food, the service, the seating, the decor, not to mention the flowers. In the entryway where the barat, the groom's party, will be received, or the mandap where the bride and groom will circle the sacred fire. Last week, the Confederation of Traders and a group of wedding professionals officially petitioned the health ministry to raise the cap on guests. They estimate that the pandemic has put 10 million informal workers out of a job. And curbs on the wedding industry further impact the jewellery business, travel and tourism, plus clothing, food, beverage, flowers, decor and the performing arts, as well as the country's GDP. Singh says that there are so many people depending on him, he's had to say yes to weddings he would not have considered before.
We cannot sit idle because we have got mouths to feed. So we are doing smaller jobs. We are doing jobs where people are going to kind of scale down the spending, but not scale it down so drastically that nothing can be done, you know, in that budget.
Gariba in Mumbai says that since the rules changed so suddenly, a few times he's had only 4 days to pull everything off. A far cry from when he'd have 2 years to plan something amazing. Some couples have dealt with guest caps and timing restrictions by inviting different sets of people at different times, for, say, a two-hour slot, or for select events, maybe just for the henna ceremony or the dance party. And when Delhi's guest list cutoff fluctuates, say to 50 or most recently 20, Singh says the people who can just change venues.
Or any of the other places. Thailand was closed. A lot of things happen in Thailand and in Indonesia, in Java. And they've flown 100 people, 150 people out there and done a spectacular wedding over there.
Back in February 2020, right before COVID changed our world so wildly, I was in a wedding party in Delhi. It was an auspicious date, or Shubh Muhurat, according to the Hindu calendar, and nearly 500 weddings happened just in Delhi that night. So Shubh, there were 3 wedding parties in my hotel that week. Our bridegroom nearly got on the wrong horse in the driveway. Weddings are still happening, of course, but in waves, just like the virus. For nearly 2 years, there were very few big fat Indian weddings. On November 21st, 2021, an auspicious day or Shubh Muhurat, Delhi saw 8,000 weddings. Hotels were packed. The city ran out of flowers. To spread things around, Gariba and others in the wedding arena are campaigning for what they're calling Har Din Shubh. Every day is blessed.
Because you never know when another wave will hit you. So you rather celebrate the day when you're ready to make the plan.
As Omicron ebbs, Singh and Gariba both say the Indian wedding industry is poised for a strong comeback.
Fundamentally, Indian weddings cannot be smaller because people want to, spend more money to show the grandeur. They want that kind of celebration for various reasons.
But I don't see the celebrations getting muted at all. People are looking forward to, are waiting to just find a reason to celebrate. And that's what our country is all about.
As for me, I think I'm ready to go attend one, as long as it's outdoors. For The World, I'm Shavi Sachdev in Mumbai.
July 1997. British rule officially ends in Hong Kong and the territory returns to China. The new relationship is framed this way: one country, two systems. Quickly, Beijing tests that idea, and by 2014, Hong Kongers are demanding that Beijing stay out of their political affairs.
This record everything. This is happening, and you're watching it.
The Umbrella Revolution, that clip from Vice News. One person with a front row seat during this whole transformation has been Mark Clifford. He lived in Hong Kong from 1992 until last year and is currently president of the Committee for Freedom in Hong Kong. He's also the author of the new book, Today Hong Kong, Tomorrow the World, What China's Crackdown Reveals About Its Plans to End Freedom Everywhere. Mark, when was that key moment for you when promises made to Hong Kong that they would remain a democracy started to break?
Well, when I started seeing my colleagues being arrested and hauled off to jail. A couple of years ago, end of February 2020, I was on the way to breakfast with the chairman of Next Digital. It was a media company. He published the biggest pro-democracy newspaper. I was on the board. I get an email from him. I'm being arrested. I can't meet you for breakfast. We now have a situation where that man, Jimmy Lai, is in jail, 74-year-old diabetic. He's one of seven people from our newspaper, Apple Daily, who are in jail, most of whom are denied bail, have no trial date, and if they're convicted, which they almost certainly will be, they could face the rest of their lives behind bars. So I guess that morning when I had just gotten in the taxi and was about to go meet Jimmy for breakfast was when the reality of it really hit.
I mean, I think of the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing when the world saw this hopeful opening that China might be easing into something less authoritarian. Did China's interference in Hong Kong happen sooner than you expected?
It's always hard to predict the future, but I think that it happened more brutally than I expected. I mean, 2-3 years ago, I mean, who would have thought we'd be talking about political prisoners in Hong Kong? I mean, we have scores of people being held without trial, and we have the complete destruction of civil society. All opposition politicians have either fled, been put in jail or silenced, newspapers shut down. So it was sooner or later, I don't know, but more brutal, absolutely.
So as the title of your book suggests, Mark, Today Hong Kong, Tomorrow the World, you believe Beijing almost sees the territory of Hong Kong as a testing ground for their approach to other parts of the world, controlling people, as you say. I mean, do you have examples of that?
Clearly, China's not going to be sending tanks into Lithuania, but tiny little Lithuania, one of those Baltic states that got its freedom 3 decades ago, is undergoing an enormous amount of pressure from China right now, simply because it had the temerity to open a trade office with Taiwan that was called a Taiwan trade office. And China just is going nuts. And so they've stopped imports from Lithuania. They've told German car makers not to use parts made in Lithuania. So they're using economic coercion in Lithuania, in Australia, in Korea, I mean, Norway, Sweden. I mean, any country that does something that China doesn't like is subject to its bully boy tactics. I mean, we can look at hundreds of examples around the world of Beijing using its economic might and its diplomatic club, really, to browbeat countries into submission. And many of them have gone along until recently. I think that's starting to change.
So the pushback to China right now is starting to get more pronounced. Where do you see that? And what do you think will come of it?
Well, I think we're starting to see it in the U.S., and we saw it under the last administration, and I think it's been surprising to the Chinese that the current administration is, if anything, even tougher on China. And so I think we're seeing in the legislative branch and the executive branch in the U.S., more of a willingness to sanction Chinese officials. So I think we're going to see a lot more collaboration between the US, the UK, and Europe, and increasingly parts of Asia, and of course, Australia. We've seen an important defense alliance between the US, the UK, and Australia. We're seeing India, Japan, and Korea in a very loose alliance to try to contain China. I mean, no one's trying to do away with China, but I think we're trying to do away with a kind of militarized, aggressive, anti-freedom sense that China is trying to impose on the world.
In the meantime, where does this leave the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong, and what does Hong Kong become?
Well, the pro-democracy movement is very much on its back foot. I mean, most of it is in jail right now. I mean, it's outrageous that people that you or I would think if they were in America or the UK would just be good citizens, and they're in jail. So, and as I said, most newspapers have been shut down, most independent newspapers, political organizations disbanded. I mean, there is no pro-democracy movement, so to speak, or no active pro-democracy movement. I mean, most Hong Kong people, always 6 out of 10 always support pro-democracy candidates. So I think there's a lot of support for democracy, but it's not an active movement.
You began the interview by talking about the closure of Apple Daily, the paper that you were on the board of, the independent newspaper that you were on the board of in Hong Kong, and the arrest of its founder, Jimmy Lai. Can you tell us what Lai's status is right now?
Jimmy Lai is a 74-year-old diabetic who's always preached nonviolence, but he's also a fierce fighter for democracy. And he now sits in a maximum security prison. I'm not really sure why, except that the Chinese seem to be intent on destroying him precisely because he exemplifies everything that's great about Hong Kong. I was just an innocent bystander. I spent my life as a journalist, ran a business association, had known Jimmy for, well, almost 3 decades. But I wasn't an activist. But seeing my colleagues carted off to jail, hearing them, you know, begging us for protection, crying, talking about the only way out being suicide. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I wake up every morning, I'm enjoying my life in America, and I think about these colleagues, you know, in the prison cell. And I just, you know, can't believe this, that they were doing what they'd done for 26 years at Apple Daily. And then all of a sudden it's gone. 500 police come into the newsroom, cart away the editor-in-chief, the CEO, you know, there are a number of other editorial people who they got later, including one who was leaving for London. They picked him up at the airport. And yeah, they're just doing what anybody in a normal country would do and what they had done for years. And I can't really rest until I've done everything I can to get the Apple Daily 7 and really whatever I can for the scores and hundreds of other political prisoners in Hong Kong.
Mark Clifford's new book is Today Hong Kong, Tomorrow the World, What China's Crackdown Reveals About Its Plans to End Freedom Everywhere. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. It's been a pleasure.
And that'll do it for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.